Well, hello there. My name is HW, and thank you so much for listening to the Tone Junkie Podcast, episode 56. Episode 56, here we go. Let's talk about what's coming up at NAMM. A new guitar I'm really excited about that I'm going to do a video on. And let's talk about happiness and contentment. Because I lately am feeling not as content as I was only a few months ago. And I am trying to get to the bottom of that. It's a general theme for me. I'm both noticing it with gear and just with life in general. But first, let's talk some guitar stuff. NAMM is coming up. HW will be there. The worship tutorial guys will be there. Nobody from Kemper will be there. However, I have exclusive word on the street that there is a Kemper event happening in the fall, just after summer, September or October. There's an event happening in Nashville at British Audio. And I believe the Kemper guys are going to be there. I don't know if this is going to coincide with any sort of announcements, any sort of sneak peeks, any sort of anything. I don't know. But we'll see. And I'm very excited to see. What am I excited to see at NAMM? I am going to go check out. Now, it's kind of a Kemper thing, right? What we do here is kind of a Kemper thing. And so I don't really feel the need to cover NAMM like, hey, there's this new thing from NAMM. Hey, there's a new thing here. Check out this new thing. This new thing. If you hear all the sound behind me, by the way, it's because I've been turned on to a new beverage. It's called English breakfast tea. And I make it out of my Keurig. And is anybody else like dumbfounded at the way every time you walk up to your Keurig, it needs new water? I put enough water in there for like 4 cups, right? Like I fill it all the way up and it could probably serve like 4 or 5 cups before you need to redo it. And I swear every time I walk up, it needs new water. Who are the animals who are not, refilling this thing with water? Or like, it's like they're timing it. It's like they're timing it so that I need water every time. Anywho, English breakfast tea, it's delicious. We're going to move out to the porch. But NAMM is, I'm excited for NAMM, but it's just summer NAMM. So there's going to be some people here. Clifton Worley's going to be here. Or tutorial guys are going to be here. It's going to be fun. I don't feel the need to cover everything, like I said, because I just feel the need to cover things that I think are really pertinent to players and pertinent to, our little Kemper community here, our little Tone Junkie haven. So I'm interested in checking out the new Vintera series from Fender. Fender's, of course, doing what everybody does every so often, which is, hey guys, after year 5, 6, or 7, it's hard to sell classic player Strats because there are so many that are used. Why wouldn't people just go buy a used one? That is a really good point, Fender. So, what's the solution? So then someone at Fender says, I got an idea. Let's get one of those cool names. You know those ones that don't mean anything, but they sound like it could be a word? Like maybe it sounds a little bit Italian or French, but we'll just, or maybe even Japanese, but we'll just name it that, like what car companies do, like Corolla, that's not a word, Camry's not a word, Sentra, it's not a word, Affinity is a word, but Focus is a word, a lot of these are words, but some of them are just things that sound like they should be words, and so that's what you do, and so someone was like, I got an idea, Vintera. Ooh, sounds interesting. Sounds like Ventura. Little California in there. Sounds a little Italian, which was a little confusing to me at first. Because I thought classic player, at least I really understood what that meant going at it. It meant classic, so I was expecting very traditional specs. And player to me meant, it's going to be affordable, meant for the player. Not as opposed to like the anniversary or the vintage reissues, the AVRIs, the anniversary vintage reissues, right? Which are like, hey, this is for the geeks, for the players too, but that we're being true to vintage form here. And so that's where we're at. That's where we're at. I'm excited to check out that Ventura. That's it. Ventura. See, it's like memorable, but not memorable. That you could almost forget it. But it's the Ventura. Let's see what's happening on the porch. Nothing much. Just good weather. Had some birds recently come live on the porch. And that was getting weird. Because they were out here every day. Every day they were out here. Okay. The other thing I'm really excited to check out is Gibson. Is I really want to see what Gibson's up to, what they're doing, you know, just like kind of what they're going to be getting at and showing off at the show. And so I think the interesting thing they've got going on is I'm sure no one from, even though it's in Nashville, I get the feeling that that show for Gibson is not an important one. And so although, I don't think Mark Agnesi's going to be around there. If he is there, I'm going to walk up to him and just start talking to him. And I'm going to say, how many guns were pointed at you during the making of that video? No. I'm going to say, what were you thinking? No, I won't say that. I will give him my card and I will say, hello. Good thing you met me. HW. Postulizer extraordinaire. At your service. I think you need my services, and I'm willing to work for Ventura series fenders. So, no, that would be an insult, wouldn't it? No, but I am excited about some of the models they have, and I would like to try some of them. And unfortunately, I just don't find myself rooting for them any longer. And that's unfortunate because here's the thing that Gibson needs to realize. Everyone's rooting for them. Even I can be turned around to root for them. At any moment, they can just show, at any moment, they could do just any of the things people believe they should be doing, and everyone would cheer for them, and they'd be back. Like, I think people love Gibson so much. They love the heritage so much. No one's really rooting against them. We're rooting against what they're doing at a moment's notice. You know what I mean? They're like the prodigal son. You know, they've wandered away and they're doing a bad thing. They're getting away from themselves. They're going and wasting, you know, everything they have. But at the moment they come back home, we're all just keeping an eye out on the horizon, aren't we? Like, hey, maybe Gibson will do something good. Maybe Gibson will just like put out a video that's like, hey guys, we're sorry. Hey guys, even just explain themselves. Like, hey guys, we really do feel, you know, I don't know, based on this, this, and this, that there's a trademark issue. I mean, I don't know how they think that. The initial trademark infringement happened 44 years ago. In 1977, sorry, 42 years ago, in 1977, Gibson didn't sue them then. They didn't even file for the trademarks then. See, because then they had these things patented, and then they expired. And the reason that Dean was able to do that in 57 or in 77 is because guess what? It was 20 years after 57 when some of the patents were expiring, and it wasn't going to make sense to go after them. They did trademark the designs, however, later in 97 and still didn't go after them. Let's not forget, they trademarked them 22 years ago. For those of you who need the inside scoop, too, on trademark, because HW has done a trademark before. I did not trademark the name HW, although I should. The interesting thing is you actually can get a trademark, but that doesn't mean it's granted in stone. Like, it doesn't mean, like, boom, you've got the trademark. You will get the trademark because the trademark office has very minuscule resources and time to actually research all the trademark cases. So unless they can find some reason not to grant you the trademark, they will grant you the trademark. That's good policy for commerce because you don't want to make trademarks too difficult to get. However, that also means it puts the sort of onus on fighting you know, junk trademarks and patents on the people who are probably the ones who the patent or trademark is going to target. So in this case, the onus is actually on Dean to show like what's why that trademark shouldn't be granted. And so there's no, and so here's the part of the system. There's no real way to do that without the person who owns the trademark coming against you. Here's what I mean by that. And this is why Gibson is another feather, no feathers in their cap is what I'm saying. I one time for a company had to get a trademark, and we talked with the trademark attorneys. And the trademark and patent attorneys, they do the same things, or they do both those services. And in terms of the marks themselves, here's the issue. From the time you get granted these things, there's about a five-year window where people can basically do whatever they want. And they can then challenge you. And when that happens, you during that 5 years, you are not defending your trademark. If you try to enforce your trademark in the first 5 years, when you go to court, you actually have to not prove that that you have a trademark and they're infringing. That's easy to prove. What you have to prove is that your trademark should have been granted and that these people don't have some claim to challenge your trademark in the first place, meaning you've still got to prove to the court that your trademark was valid because it's a new trademark. I don't know how patents, if patents follow that same design, but we were told by our attorneys, understand that this trademark protects you. It was a very particular case. We were trademarking a term, and the other thing you have to understand is this. Trademarks don't apply universally across the board in the way patents do. If you have a technology that is a better technology for cutting wood, I'm out here on my front porch, so I'm looking at trees, so I'm just thinking of something in front of me. If you have a better technology that processes wood, right, and you develop this technology and then you patent it and you use it for the purposes of more quickly making more quickly processing lumber in a lumber mill, which gives you an advantage on producing lumber for new home builders, right? If that's what you do, you've developed this technology that better processes wood. And the patent will spell out what that process is. And it might be the process of taking a tree, treating it with this biochemical that we've invented and doing blah, 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 blah. Now, let's say someone else comes along later and they're not even in your industry. They're trying to go make more paper, right? They might discover or come across they might look at your patent and go, interesting. And they might go, well, what if we did it a little differently this way? And then they might do something similar and they might produce better paper, right? Better paper products. You have a patent on the process. Now, if their process is not different enough from your process, that your patent, the wording in your patent, it's very technical stuff. The wording in your patent may or may not be worded in such a way that it covers their new process. So the only determining factor here, whether they owe you money or whether they need to license your patented process from you, the only thing, it might not even be what they've invented. It might be how your patent is worded. So the system is very convoluted. But here's the thing. Patents apply to processes and they apply across industries, which is why you can get people going after other people you can get patent trolls who will buy a patent and then go after people, and it's just like ridiculous. It doesn't make any sense. You can get people who they're patent trolls, and you can see documentaries on this. They buy a patent that talks about creating playlists or distributing things over the internet. Then they go and sue the Joe Rogan podcast or the Adam Carolla podcast. And the reason they can do this is because they don't want to enforce their patent against Apple. They know they'll get beat. So they go after somebody else who they can just say, give me $200,000 instead of defending yourself in court. Because if you defend yourself in court, it'll cost you $500,000. And so these podcasts will go, okay, fine. I'll give you $100,000. That's all I got.
I'll give you $200,000, fine. Trademarks, however, have to do with where you're actually doing the business, your industry. So if I go get a trademark and I say, I want to trademark the term HW Nose Tone, well, that trademark may work for someone involved in blah, 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 blah industry or blah, 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 blah thing. So it might be this trademark, HW Nose Tone, protects this mark and is only to be used by, you know, Jonathan Sullivan in this industry. It's being used for the purpose of promoting guitar technology content via podcast, YouTube, and other video and audio platforms across the web, blah, 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 blah. What that means is that if someone, it also can apply sometimes only to a geographic area. So meaning Jimmy Subs or JD Sub Shop, you can get a trademark on that. And if you do business in LA, you cannot go then sue the guy. You can have that trademark. You can't go then sue a guy named JD for trying to do that same thing in New York because it's not material to your to the success of your business. It's not it has no bear. It's a different market. You don't have a reason to protect that mark there. Now, if you go start doing business in New York, you better go do it before he opens up his shop because you can bring that trademark over, but you're not over there. So you can't just enforce this anywhere. Okay, that's a little bit of about what I know about trademarks. Here's what's interesting about that. Gibson's patents expired, at which point they try and go get a trademark. Here's the thing you got to understand. Trademarks do not protect you. It's not the guitars that Dean has that they're suing them about. They can't, the trademark cannot enforce that. It's about the shape itself, and it might even be the shape in its printed form, meaning they might even be able to go after Dean and say, you cannot put this shape guitar in publication. You cannot put this shape guitar in written format, in video format. It's our mark. That mark is synonymous with our brand, the shape. Not the patent on how we designed a bridge. Not the patent on how we designed the body. Not the patent. That has to do with the product and the process of making the patent. The trademark, it's the actual shape. And so they could get in trouble for not even just making the guitars a different shape, but even if that mark appears in printed form, there's been trademark cases that get into the angles of things, meaning you could have a trademark. Let me postulate for a second. Dean could actually change the shape of the instrument, but if in a publication, they don't, meaning Dean could put circles on the end of the V, right? They could put big circles. But if they cut off those circles in a photo and publish that, that could still be a trademark violation. Because now the mark they're portraying, it's very interesting stuff, very, very convoluted stuff. I remember in our, and here's what's interesting too, I remember in our case, our trademark only protected us at the distributor level of the product, meaning we were a distributor getting a trademark on certain words. And they said, now listen, this only protects you at the distributor level. If a manufacturer used this in your same industry, so in this case it was clothing, they said if any distributor uses the term, this particular term, you can enforce your trademark against them. You can tell them to stop. But if a manufacturer does it, this trademark provides you no protection. Interesting. These things can be very convoluted. I don't think it's a coincidence, by the way, that Gibson has waited 22 years to enforce these trademarks. They could have done it before. There's nothing new about this. I think the game they're playing is they've had this trademark for 22 years, and they believe that there was infringement, and they've been sending cease and desist letters hoping to work with them. But I think I think that's a ruse. I think they're just trying to make their case stronger by allowing this trademark to exist for a longer period of time before they bring it to court. And I think the other reason is they didn't care about doing this until Dean was purchased by the distributor. Dean is now owned by a distributor. I think now there's an actual threat in the terms of the number of distribution. I don't think they cared to go after them before. It didn't seem worth it. I think, though, however, you're going to see a different thing from Gibson now, realizing, looking at the history. I think this new management is going to look at the history of Gibson and say, it's been a mistake in the past to look at brands and say, it's not worth it to go after them, even though we think they had a case. Meaning, if all things were equal and they were doing 100 times the amount of sales they were doing, we would go after them. But because they're so small, it's not worth our effort. I think you're not going to see that anymore, because Gibson's now going to realize that Gibson now being in their fourth or fifth iteration of company management, it's been a mistake over the past 4 or 5 decades to ignore people, because eventually those brands can get sold to other brands that are bigger, and bada bing, bada boom, now you've got yourself a situation where you've got to go and figure out, hey, that company you bought, they actually were violating our trademarks, and now we're going to do something about it. And now you've got this uphill battle, right? I also think Gibson is just, I don't really know what they're doing. I think there could be some pressure from shareholders here. I think part of this is they announced a plan to these investors and these banks, and this is probably just part of the plan, how they're going to get this done. They probably said, look, this current management, not only are they doing all these other things, but we have a wealth of IP, a wealth of intellectual property, and I don't think that we're doing a good job enforcing it. I bet you that was sold to the banks who extended more credit, who really just extended longer lines of credit, right? You see, here was Gibson's case, and here's what happens in a bankruptcy. Gotta love that English breakfast tea. Here's what happens in these cases. The company, when they're bankrupt, they go to the debtors and say, look, sometimes their debt can be converted to stock. That probably wasn't the case with Gibson. But probably at that point, the stock was... Henry still owns a ton of Gibson. You got to realize that. He still owns a lot of Gibson. He probably had to give up a lot. The shareholders... the debtors become the shareholders, in the sense that they have to be reasonably assured that whatever change is going to take place warrants them to extend more money. So basically, they might loan Gibson $1 million or $10 million or $100 million, whatever. And then when Gibson doesn't pay, they have to go, okay, what's our new deal? You owe us the money. We'll liquidate you. We know you're worth more, not in liquidation. Right? You're worth more if we can keep you liquid and you can do certain things. So we need to put in a team that's going to know how to do that, that we're confident with. And ideas get thrown around. This is a pitch. This is a pitch. What are you going to do? Mark Agnesi has to have had a vision to get in there. The CEO has a vision to get in there. JC has a vision. And he previously has taken companies that were past their prime and returned them to profitability. There has to be ways to do that. One of these ways might be, I'm sure this was said, I can't imagine this wasn't pitched, of, hey, we have a wealth of IP that we think, even without doing anything, just in current market conditions, could raise our sales 8%. Because we need to take back some of these, some of this IP violation that's happening, that's resulting in sales for Dean, for other companies. That has to be in a plan, that, you know, a 5-fold plan, a 7-fold plan of what they're going to do. I'm sure that's in there, because those guys love that stuff. Oh, they love that stuff. They love all that legal mumbo junk. They love that stuff. The stuff they don't like, because that's like more guaranteed, right? It's more concrete. You could really sink your teeth into it. I worked with these corporate types. They're the worst people on the planet. They're just unimaginative. That's what it is. I bet the park, I bet they at some point have a plan, but I'm telling you, there's a lot of these types who wouldn't care. That Gibson says, I think we know how to raise sales 30%, and it's by doing the right thing, making great stuff again. It's by making things people want. But I'm sure they did that too. Okay, enough about Gibson. I'm getting sick of talking. I actually went and looked at Dean guitars online. Gosh, I couldn't really find one I wanted. I couldn't really find one I liked. So I don't know what to do about that. Maybe at some point I'm thinking of buying an Epiphone Explorer and then just writing Dean on the headstock. Anyway. So I'm excited to see Gibson there. I'm excited to see a couple people. You know who else I'm excited about? And I think, you know, I got some, I'm thinking about something. I got this new guitar and I haven't really been this content with the pickups. It's got McNellys in it and the McNellys are fine. I'm growing a little discontent because I don't have a set of Cremas. And I kind of feel like I need a set of Lambertone Cremas. Now, if you don't know, Lambertone's, Curtis Lamberton from Lambertone, he's making these pickups, and they're just all the rage on the internet right now. They're all the rage, especially in the praise and worship circles. People are saying these pickups have the high end of a single coil, sort of the lower end snap of a single coil, but they're humbuckers. But they don't sound like single coils. They sound like humbuckers, but like with these great single coil qualities. People say they're better than the Lawler El Reyos. People say they're better than the Veritas Bearcats. People say these are it. I know one guy. A lot of you might know Troy from a YouTube channel called Guitar for His Glory. I don't know if he's endorsed or what, but he shouts them out everywhere. He puts them in all his guitars. He says, I believe in this product. So maybe he got some of those things for free. I happen to know that Lambertone is a fairly small company. I really don't believe they're paying anyone. I'm almost 99% sure they're not paying anyone. Apart from maybe a cup of coffee and some free pickups. But I think everyone who is shouting these things out at least bought their first pair. Someone like Troy who has, you know, I think he has these Lambertones in four pairs of guitars now. He's pulling out these amazing pickups from these Elliots, these $4,000 guitars. No shade, by the way. No shade on anyone for having a $4,000 guitar. I'm into that. I'm still considering eventually buying an Elliot. I'm just also trying to build a back deck. My wife wants to redo some. She wants to cover the back deck here. So I can't really buy any guitars until we do that. But who am I kidding? I'll have a guitar next week, I'm sure. but no, he's putting them all in. So, you know, maybe he got hooked up with a couple pairs for free or something. But I happen to know that he bought several of those. They're supposed to be amazing pickups. He's putting them in everything. He's going, these pickups are it. These are them. Which I'm like, wow, okay. And now I see they got some new P90s coming out that apparently were made for David Ryan Harris. So I don't even know. I can't even confirm that rumor. Apparently, these are made for some people who know good pickups. And I want some. So I think I got to figure out a way to get my hands on some of these. Some of these Cremas and some of these new P90s. I think HW is going to develop a plan to find out how to get some of these pickups. Get them in my guitars. And know once and for all, put away the questions. Are the Cremas the creme de la creme? How is that not the slogan, by the way? The creme de la creme of pickups. How are the creme? I know he's really into coffee, but I'm into English breakfast tea at the moment. I want to talk about contentment on the rest of the podcast today. And this might go somewhere, and this might turn into a long one. So that's probably it for guitar content, but guitar stuff will weave in and out of the rest of the podcast today. You know, that right there is a good example of me
in my head and my heart having different feelings that compete with each other. It's as simple as going, wow, I see these amazing pickups on these guitars, and I see everyone super excited about them. And it what does it do? It grows an amount of discontentment in me to where I say, I love Sir S90 pickups. I love them. They're amazing. They're my favorite pickups. And I start to go, well, what if those are better? Like, what I have is amazing, but look at those P90s from the guy who did the Cremas. Look at that. That's amazing. Oh, did you hear that? Oh, it sounds beautiful. And so it makes me take a step back and go, what has changed here? What's changed from weeks ago, months ago, before I heard of whatever the new guitar or new pickup or new whatever was? What's changed between then and now? Then I coveted a thing. I had this thing, this S90, in a JM Pro. I had another JM Pro with SSVs. And they were it. They were all I wanted. And then I learned about a new thing. I became aware of it. Awareness to me is a significant thing too, because a lot of times I'm thinking about awareness from a marketing perspective. I'm thinking about making people aware of things, of Tone Junkie releases, making people aware of songwriting things, online things that I'm working on the side, making people aware of this product or that company or these things, right? So what happened? I became aware of something. And that changed my feelings, right? It now became that I elevated something to the level of the S90s. I had something that there was something I wanted. And I had it. And I was content. And then I became aware of something else. And I elevated that something else in my psyche, in my perception. That thing took the form of being a peer, the equivalent of this S90, this thing that I wanted and now I have. And now I want two things, but I only have one. Rather than wanting one thing and having that thing. So now I have half of what I want, whereas before I had all of what I want. They're just guitar pickups, but what I'm saying applies to anything. What has changed outside of me? Nothing. The S90s existed. The Sir pickups, the ones that were my favorite, are my favorite. They existed. I wanted them. I had them. I possessed them. I am happy with them. The Cremas existed, though I was not aware of it. These new Lambertone P90s existed, though I was not aware of them. And if I was aware of them, I did not perceive them to be on the level of the thing that I was holding dear. But now, I see them as that good, that important, that desirable. And so, I attach some amount of my accomplishment, some amount of my happiness to possessing them. Because look how good they are. Because I sit here observing them, wanting them. And in that wanting them, I become discontent because my perspective changes from I have all that I want to I have half of what I want.
What has changed outside of me? Nothing. What has changed on the inside of me? Everything. So what does that mean about my contentment, my happiness? Well, if my happiness, if we were to graph this out and show, here is one line on a graph moving, and here is, and that represents things outside of me, and its movement up and down is the movement of things outside of me, and yet my happiness is on another line, moving up and down, as people are more or less happy day to day, week to week, month to month, whatever, in a moment, out of a moment, right? You get cut off in traffic, you're less happy than when your favorite song came on. Or maybe you're just showing more signs of it. I don't know. But imagine these two lines. Are they really, really, really dependent on each other? Do the lines move together? Are they related? If things are changing on one line outside of me, but my happiness doesn't change, then it can't be that the things outside of me make me happy. It can't be that things happening in the world make me happy. Now, not all the time. There of course has to be externalities that affect your happiness, your joy. You have children, you're overcome with joy. You get married, you're overcome with joy. You lose someone you loved, you're overcome with grief. You mourn, you feel. Of course, externalities affect your emotional state. But we're the only creatures that can affect our mood, our emotions, that can put ourselves in laughter or in sorrow with our thoughts. We just change our thinking. We could be in the exact same place. My wife lost her mom when she was 17. She died of cancer. And my wife, on Mother's Day or on the anniversary of her mother's birthday, will sometimes cry. Sometimes I'll see her watching a video and sometimes not. Sometimes she just spends the whole day with us. Sometimes she doesn't even realize it's the anniversary of her mother's passing. Sometimes on Mother's Day, we just are having so much fun. And then every now and then I notice in the evening or something, I'll catch her reading a card or a letter, the letter that her mom wrote her when she knew she was going to pass, watching the video that her mother wrote her, that her mother filmed for her. Nothing's changed. We just have a calendar that reminds us. We move our thoughts towards something that is an externality, that can affect our joy, that can affect our sorrow. We move our thoughts there and then we experience it. But if we don't move our thoughts there, we don't experience it. So how to be happy? Maybe there's some Buddhist monk. Maybe there is someone who has so mastered their emotions and their thoughts that they can be free from the influence of externalities on their own happiness. Maybe. Unlikely. But it would appear to me that everyone can affect their mood, their happiness, their level of contentment just by controlling their own thoughts. I sometimes am taken with this feeling of like, I can't tell if the discontentment that I feel sometimes It's not just in guitars. I'm not talking about pickups anymore. I wasn't then either. Some of you got that. You knew, you realized, I mean, he's not talking about pickups. Some of them come from noble endeavors, you know? Some of them come from wanting things for your kids that you didn't have. Some of them comes from wanting things for your kid that you did have, and you could be in danger of not giving them. And how does that make you feel, knowing that you were provided something, but what if your kids weren't provided that same opportunity, that same chance, that same advantage? What does that say for you if you were given the advantage and couldn't even pass it forward? One thing I've learned, and it's so obvious with gear, but yet it's less obvious in other areas of my life, but I know it's just as true, is that it doesn't matter how much you have. It doesn't matter how much you can get. If enough isn't enough for you, you'll never have enough. And that's where I feel stuck. I was somewhere for a long time that I had peace. I was content. Not with everything. You see, there's this other, this level of contentment. I mean, I had peace. I was a little bit discontent in the sense that I had these long-term goals. Here's what I want. I want these things out there. I want this for my family. I want this for myself. I want this for my church. I want this for my community. I want this for my friends and the people that I am, I hate this term, but I'm going to use it, doing life with, right? I want to be able to help this person in this way. I want to be able to help my church in this way. I want to be able to provide for my kids in this way. I want to be able to accomplish this thing. And some amount of that is healthy. Some amount of that is the reason why I hashtag profile the world. Some amount of that is the reason why I think I want every single Kemper owner user on the face of this planet to try and have and enjoy a Tone Junkie pack. I want more people to see the videos. I want people to know about it. I want to do more things. I want to profile every amp. I want to make a pedal. I want to build something. I want to give to my church. I want to help the things I believe in. I want to help solve the problems for people, that especially were the problems that touched me. I want to help kids who need wheelchairs get wheelchairs, because wheelchairs and surgeries almost bankrupted my family and basically did on like three occasions growing up, because my brother needed surgeries and needed a wheelchair. And guess what? Wheelchairs are super expensive. And guess what? Wheelchairs are kind of like shoes. You grow out of them. So you put your kids in wheelchairs that are too big for them, and then they grow into them, and then you keep them in these wheelchairs that are a little bit too small for them until they just can't do it anymore. And you have to get another one. And God, I remember having this big, old, crappy van growing up. My dad had this big, old, crappy Chevy van, and the back was converted to a big, old wheelchair lift. But at that time, see, now you have these cool minivans that are converted to wheelchair lifts. And the slide door opens up and they're very sleek. A little ramp comes down. No, at that time you open this big Chevy sort of camping van. You open the back door and this giant lift folded down, went down. You wheeled the wheelchair on it. And it was like, it was basically a lift gate that you would see in the back of a large delivery truck. It was a lift gate, but designed for wheelchairs put on the back of vans. And it would bring a thing, and you would strap down a wheelchair with all these belts and stuff. Now the wheelchairs are designed with just a steel ball at the bottom and a clamping mechanism, and it keeps it in there, and they're a lot better now. They're a lot safer too. And then you have these things where, like, in my brother's situation, he lives in California. He's an adult now. My mother takes care of him. She has a conservatorship over him. He's technically a ward of the state, but we wouldn't let him go to a facility. But I mean, he's an adult. No one has custody of him because he's an adult now. When you're a kid, you have custody. When you're not a kid, and you can't take care of yourself, you technically are a ward of the state, but someone has a conservatorship over you, meaning the court has said, the state ultimately looks after all people who can't look after themselves. But in the case of you have someone who can better look after you, who loves you and who will take care of you and has your best interest in mind, they grant a conservatorship, and that person is your they conserve you. They take care of you and make all decisions for you, and any money that the state gives for your provision is granted to them. I will tell you, it is not a lot of money, especially you in California. And they have all these really weird, interesting things where my brother can't go to a dentist. You can't explain to him. He doesn't have the mental capacity to understand. He needs to open his mouth and not fight someone maybe doing something uncomfortable at a dentist office, because it's for his own good. He can't fathom this. So he fights and turns and jerks his head all around and says, don't poke me or don't put anything in my mouth. Just leave me alone. So he has to be sedated. So they sedate him to do dentistry. Well, what will happen if they don't do any dentistry? His teeth will fall out. Well, so where do you do sedated dentistry? Well, you have to have, you have to go to a hospital. You have to have someone sedate you. Well, to be sedated, you need an anesthesiologist. So you need to rent a hospital facility. You need to have an anesthesiologist so that the dentist can come in and do his job. None of this is covered by Medi-Cal, Medicare, Meta-anything. None of it. They won't cover it. Now they say, well, we'll cover standard toothbrushes and things, but we will not cover sedated dentistry. We will not cover it because it's not a medical necessity. However, if your teeth go bad and they're providing you pain, well, that's a quality of life issue. So we'll pay to have the teeth removed. And then if you have no teeth, we'll pay for your food to be provided to you in liquid form, because you poor baby, you're handicapped. You don't have the mental faculty to understand you have to do dentistry. So this is the type of thing that has made me a libertarian over these years. I'm grateful that we have a country that cares for people like my brother who can't care for themselves. I'm grateful for that. I'm not grateful, though, for the bureaucracy intertwined in it that says to someone, no, we won't cover what they need to keep their teeth healthy. You got to do that on your own. I don't know why I'm saying this into a podcast. I'm sorry, guys. This I meant to talk about guitars. This is kind of opening like a wound for me, I think. Felt like a little while ago, I had purpose. I was focused.
and the right things, you know? Like, I had one master, one thing, that above all was good. And that was the thing I was after. You know? And sometimes what I'm saying is, it's like this, right? It's like they say that this is a Bible thing. This is what it says in the Bible. It says the kingdom of heaven is like a man who comes across a field, and there's a great treasure in the field, and he sells everything he has to acquire the field. He sells everything he has because the treasure, because listen, this is what it means. The kingdom of heaven, by the way, is not a spiritual thing. It's not heaven. So if you're not a Christian, if you're not a spiritual person, just listen to me. This doesn't even have to be a religious lesson, because it's actually a truth about human beings. It's codified in religion. It's codified, and I believe it's true, and it's part of Christianity. But it's a truth that is not so exclusively belonging to Christianity. It's been discovered by other people as well. Because anyone can observe the madness that comes from always wanting more, from always needing more. And even this, even in being governed, in being fueled by pursuits that are maybe even noble, but can't bring you happiness. I think it's this. This is why I was having a moment a minute ago. I become discontent and I become angry that my dad having his own business and me being what I regard as somewhat successful, that still something like needing to provide for my family can knock us over with the sheer cost of it. What would you do if your teeth cleaning cost $30,000? Because that's what I'm talking about. It costs $30,000 to go to the dentist and to go to a dentist and to say, we need you to get the hospital facility and the anesthesiologist, do the work and pay everyone. And what do they say? They say, of course, you got to pay up front. And this happens every 18 months, every 24 months. And on top of that, boom, we find, hey, you know what? There needs to be a root canal. We need this. We need that. Because that's what people need. It's the feeling of feeling like you can't get ahead, no matter what you do. How could you ignore? You know? It's because if I let my happiness be determined by some level of accomplishment, some level of what I can do, what I can provide, who I can save today, then I'll always find more suffering. I'll always find more hardship, and I'll never be content. More will never be enough if enough is always a little more. I'm like, I'm realizing that I don't have joy because I've invested my emotions in the wrong thing. I've invested them in how much I have. Not because I buy dumb shit. Like, I mean, maybe someone's perception of me is this guy's a Tesla. What an asshole. I'm sorry, I cursed twice here. You know what I'm saying? I have the cheapest Tesla you can get. I mean, it was a little bit of a splurge, but, you know, they give you $4,000 back. Now that Donald Trump has this extra thing, I mean, I'm saving $10,000 on taxes the first year just from the write-off because I'm self-employed now. So the $4,000 they give back plus the $6,000, plus they're letting me write off $18,000 worth of the car in the first year? Oh, my word, it's hard not to do it. So, yeah. HW, you got like a million amps. What are you complaining about money for? I don't keep all the amps. Obviously, I'd go broke. You can't buy $3,000 amps every week and keep them all. A lot of times people, they message me, they're like, "Hey, can you put the Benson Monarch with the new 65 Deluxe Reverb?" I'm like, "The Benson Monarch, I sold that thing 2 years ago. I'm not hanging on to it would be like $250,000 in gear I must have downstairs. There's no, I couldn't even fit all that in my house. Although I do have a buddy who's going to buy a Benson Monarch, and so I might do some duels with it. I'm trying to convince him. I'm solely just convincing him. Hey, just, yeah, it's a really great amp, dude. Really great amp. Selfishly, I want him to buy it, though. The thing about the field is about the kingdom of heaven. It's about where we are right now. It's about like a state of living. It's not about heaven. It's not about dying and going to heaven. That's not what the kingdom of heaven is when it's talked about in the Bible. You can disagree with me on that if you want. That's not the kingdom of heaven. Because they were saying at the time, you have to get the context. They were saying at the time, "Lord, Lord, are you going to lead a rebellion?" Do you know that the disciples of Jesus were all named after famous men who had died and fought against Rome? Did you know that? Did you know that in Nazareth, where he was born, they had stopped an insurrection against Rome about 20, 30 years before Jesus was born? And did you know that those names, those common names, Jacob, Joshua, they were all named after people who had been named after fathers and named after people in Judaism, but they were named directly after the people who had fought against Rome just 20 and 30 years earlier. It's actually how some people still do it in the Middle East. Because those people were freedom fighters. They were fighting. Jesus himself is named after Joshua, the most heroic of all the conquerors in Israel. Think about it. Yahshua. That's his name. His name was Yahshua. Yeshua. He was named after the most famous conqueror, the one who went in and slayed giants in the land that they then inhabited. They didn't name him Moses II, the second deliverer. They didn't name him Adam II. They didn't name him. They named him that. It's a clue into the psyche of the people. There was a rebellion 30 years after him, and there were people calling for rebellion. They constantly tried to get him into a corner. You can hear it in the questions. Is it right to pay tax to Rome? Why would they even ask that question if there was not a contingency among them who believed it was wrong? If embedded in the idea of being a faithful Jew was that we shouldn't be paying anything to anyone else, only to God. They were looking for a conqueror. So they would ask him about his kingdom, your kingdom. And what they meant was, when you rise up, and when we go with you, and when we all overthrow Rome, when we are a nation state once again, when Israel will be free once again, what's that kingdom going to be like? And he said, I'll tell you, the kingdom of heaven is like a man who comes across a field, and there's a great treasure in the field. And here's the subtext. That treasure, the subtext is this, because of what is said next, right? What's said next is he sells everything he has to acquire it. Why would you do that? You'd only do it if the treasure was better than everything you had. And if nothing you had was worth holding on to instead of getting that treasure, if nothing you had was of equal value to the treasure, if nothing you had was of any use at all compared to the treasure, it doesn't say he sold everything he had except for the bare essentials, then got the treasure. It doesn't say he schemed to get the treasure and everything he had. It doesn't say he desired the treasure. It says he sold everything he had to get the treasure. That's how great the treasure was. Nothing he had compared. He would rather sell. It was a no-brainer. Sometimes I feel like if the kingdom of heaven is that guy who comes across a field and he sees the treasure and is better than everything he's got, and he sells everything to get it, I feel like the guy who comes across the field, sees the treasure, and says, oh my gosh, look at that treasure. It's so great. Sell everything I have to, and in the process of selling everything, I start to doubt. How good was that treasure again? Or maybe I forget how valuable it looked, how valuable it seemed. And I go, well, look. I could sell everything and get it, I know. But look, some of this other stuff was good, right? I don't have a problem selling my Ferrari. I don't have a problem selling my Tesla, whatever. If you could get, like, you know what I'm saying? It's not that stuff. But like, what about some of these other things? What about these goals I had that I was going to do this for my kids? What about these goals that I had that I was going to do this, that I was going to provide this for my wife, because I've wrapped up in providing for my wife and my kids and getting to this level of something, right? I have wrapped up in outdoing my father and in providing more for my father. And part of that is being generous. So that's how I justify it, right? Isn't being generous being good? Well, to be this generous, I have to be this successful. To be this successful, I have to stay up this many nights with no sleep. I have to do this many things. I have to do more. I have to get this and that. And aren't those things noble too? And so should I give those things up? I thought they were good. Look, I can justify them. They're good. I guess good's the enemy of the great, huh? Everything's permissible. Not everything's beneficial. I don't know. I don't know. What's scary is I think I do know.
bet those crema sound really good, huh?
They're just pickups. My wife said to me, she said, I see it so clearly in you. You'll never have enough. She said, you're a seven. You always want to try new things, do more. She said, you'll never have enough because there isn't an amount you'll feel like is enough. She says, you accomplish your goals many times, and it seems as though once you do, you forget they were your goals. You don't really rejoice in them. You just, in the process of achieving one goal, you don't even celebrate it. You just, while you're achieving it, you formulate another goal further out. I don't think it's the worst thing, but I do think it robs me of some of the joy I should have today. I'm often not present with my kids mentally. I mean, not as much as I should be. I mean, I take time and I put everything down and I spend time with them, but sometimes I'm just so wrapped up in work. These might be the longest pauses ever on the Tone Junkie podcast. I don't know where I've gone here. I've gone somewhere. Yeah. I think I need to refocus. I need to renew my mind. I need to renew my mind and align myself again with the things that were very important and that gave me happiness. But it's funny, last thing I'll say here, my wife said something interesting to me. She said, it was about that same thing, you know, you're not going to have enough. She actually said the thing, you'll never have enough if enough is always a little more. You'll never have enough if always is a little more. Sorry, you'll never have enough if enough is always a little bit more. How much is enough? Just a little more. Is it enough yet? No, just a little more. That's called an addiction. If that thing gives you negative consequences, that's called an addiction. I think. But it's funny what I realized when she said that. I said to her, no, listen. I don't even want more. You misunderstand. It's not more for the sake of more. It's not more for the sake of more, you know? I don't want more. I would give up everything. I would sell everything 100% if it felt like enough. I don't want more for more's sake. I want more so I can feel free. Free from the fear of not having enough. Free from that fear. I just want the peace. I constantly am playing out in my head all the time. What series of events could happen that could bring me to ruin? that could bring me to the point where I say, I'm sorry, kids, I have to sell the house. I'm sorry, kids, you can't go to your school anymore. I'm sorry, kids, you know what I'm saying? Things that would leave me feeling like a failure. That's the thing I need the peace from. That's why I'm always after more. It's not for the more. It's because I'm hoping that more builds these walls around me that protect me from the fear of not having enough, but it always gets through. I have no peace. I have no rest. But I know the answer. Come to me, all who are weary, all who are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. My burden is light. My yoke is easy. But part of me convinces myself that it's in the hardness of the work. That when I feel that hard work, that hardness, when I feel exhausted, when I walk around at 3 a.m., when I walk around with 3 hours of sleep because I was up all night doing something, building an email funnel thing for this new project, when I walk around the next day, that feeling of being tired, a little bit irritable, that tiredness is a reminder. No one's going to eat your lunch. You're doing it. You're doing everything you need to do to stay ahead, to stay ahead. You're not slipping backwards. You're going forward. And logically, I could look and I can go, what are you talking about? You're not going to lose your house. You're not going to have to take your kids out of school. These thoughts aren't logical. Why are you afraid of these things that are so far away? You have 100 options before then. This isn't even a thing. You're fine. You have more than enough. Why are you afraid of not having enough when you have more than enough? Do you see in your history some track record of not having enough? No. Do you see in your history some track record of you not being able to provide enough? No, not really. So then where does it come from? Where does it come from? That fear, that anxiety about it, that lack of peace, where does it come from? It comes from having an old mind, not a renewed one. It comes from forgetting. It comes from believing that you are David. See, I used to listen to that story. The one, you know, David and Goliath, the little kid and the giant. And he slays the giant. I used to read that story and I would look at that story and I would do what most people do. I would say, wow. In that story, I'm David. My problem is Goliath. And my faith in God is my faith in God. And he will give me, he will deliver me. The Lord delivers me. The Lord delivers me. He will give me what I need to slay the giant. And at the end, I'll say, the Lord did it. I don't think that's what that story means. I don't think we're David. You see, listen, in that story, all of the people of Israel, the fighting men, they cower in fear before what is their impending doom, before Goliath, who will kill them all, him and his army will kill them all. And David walks in, and here's the thing about the story that really makes me realize we are not David in the story, in the allegorical side of the story. Yes, it's historical. To what degree, no one can know for sure, but it is historical. But in sort of the allegory, why is it carried on in the tradition of Judaism as a moral story? What does it mean? We're not, the reason I know we're not David is this, is that David approaches and he does not say to his brothers, I have an idea. Or like, hey guys, what are we going to do about this? He just immediately moves in. He immediately moves in. I can kill that giant. He has a sure faith, all right? He knows what will happen. He's also the least of them, like a man who comes from Galilee, some podunk town that was destroyed just like one generation earlier. It'd be like a man coming from Detroit today. He slays the giant, and the giant falls dead. And they make him the king. Not then and there. And he goes through a whole bunch of stuff. Some people throw swords at him, spears at him. He has to go hide. He has to actually hide among the Philistines for a while. The people whose giant he killed. I think in that story, we are the people, we are the fighting men, and we cower, and we are afraid. Though we are suited for battle, we are afraid, because there is a giant. Death is coming. It comes for us all. And David is Christ. He comes in and the one who looks weak, the one who is not glorified. He comes and he slays the giant. When I believe I'm David, when I believe I'm David, I look at heaven and I say, all right, let's do it. Come on. Let's get on it. We got a giant to slay. Let's go do it. I got a rock. Let's go. And sometimes that's it. Sometimes that works. Listen, sometimes... We need a lot of people who are doing things, who are helping people. We don't need more passive people in the world. We really don't. We could use a lot more active people who are actively trying to make things better, who are actively trying to help people in their community, who are actively giving, who are actively aiding. We need more of that. We do. But when you internally believe that it is all about what you are doing, all about the story of you, even if you say God is empowering that story, when you do that, you do a profound disservice, I believe, as I am doing now. Because then you treat God not as God. You treat You treat God like the cup which you can dip in the water of heaven and pour out over your own work to bless it, to make it happen. You treat God like the ladle that takes a bit of the heavenly water and pours it down on your life. You treat him like the delivery system. Come on, God, I got a rock. I got faith in a rock. But God is not the ladle. He is not the ladle that delivers the water. He is the wellspring of life himself. To put it in today's terms, he's not the delivery guy at your door. He is Amazon 2-hour delivery. He's not the thing that delivers the little bit of heaven, the little bit of blessing. He's not the thing that delivers the little bit of power. He's not the thing that makes the rock take its path and go right there and knock out the giant. He's the David in the big story. He's the one who came to free us from death and dying, to lighten our load, to do all that. If you are not a Christian, I apologize that I am maybe boring you or something. You've probably tuned out already. This is just my belief, you know, my experience as a human. And I can't for the life of me understand how I forget that the spring is not the spoon. That the water is not the cup. I don't know. I don't know how I forgot. I don't even know when I forgot. I promise you, 3 months ago, 2 months ago, I was so on. And today I don't feel that on. In the last month, I haven't felt that on. I have felt a lack of peace. I felt bothered. And it's because of the subtlety, I think. The slip. The slip of my focus. Maybe even saying it was the slip of my focus is wrong. Maybe that even gives me too much. I don't know. I really don't. If you are listening this far, I probably owe you some money. Because I would have paid a therapist more than you're getting for all of this. Thanks so much for listening to the Tone Jogi Podcast, episode 56. I've been HW. HW out.